KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Expecting clouds and showers again tomorrow, the high in the mid-50s.
I'm not a career politician. I'm an experienced, effective manager committed to fair elections and increased voter participation.
I'm the only candidate in this race that has the elected executive level experience doing this job at the county level.
Well, there are so many variables in this conflict, and the fact that it's gone on for 20 months means that it also, in many respects, has turned into a proxy war. This is no longer just a question of, shall we say, pro-democracy activists in Syria.
Good Friday morning. I'm Katie Sewell, sitting in this morning for Steve Scheer. That last voice you just heard was Scott Peterson. He was in Aleppo all week this week and has just gotten back out to Turkey. We'll talk to him a little later in the hour to find out what's going on in the ground in Syria. But first, we continue our quest to become informed voters as we get to know the candidates for Secretary of State. Joining us in the studio, Republican Kim Wyman is Thurston County Auditor. Before that, she served 9 years as election manager. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And Democrat Kathleen Drew is a former Washington State Senator and policy advisor to Governor Chris Gregoire. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
And if you have any questions, feel free to email us. Our email address is weekday@kuow.org. And I wanted to start with the very basics. The question that nobody could seem to answer when I was asking around is, what does the Secretary of State do when they're not overseeing an election? Do one of you want to take that?
Well, certainly the Secretary of State is the chief elections officer, which is supervising the elections that are managed at the county level, but also the chief corporations officer. All corporations, charitable organizations, and domestic partners file with the Secretary of State's office. So that's something that not very many people know, as well as in charge of the archives. The constitutional duty of the Secretary of State is to keep the records of the executive and legislative branch, and that's the archives, as well as the state library and also the address confidentiality program for victims of domestic violence. So very broad, eclectic portfolio.
Sounds like a lot of paperwork.
It does, but I think also a lot of people work.
Yeah. And isn't there also sort of a ambassador role when we have visiting dignitaries here?
Yes, both Sam Reed and Ralph Monroe really kind of expanded that part of the office and connecting with other countries. So yes, definitely ambassador for the state as well.
So let's start off. This office has been traditionally, in at least as long as Sam Reed has held it, a nonpartisan office. Do you think that it should be a more active political office than it is? Let's go first, you, Kim.
No, I think that it is imperative that the Secretary of State is politically neutral because of the election oversight piece and checking petitions for referendum and initiative. It's really important that people trust what's happening in that office and that they believe that the person running it doesn't have a partisan agenda and isn't really trying to affect the outcome of an election because of their partisan leanings.
Okay, Kathleen Drew.
I definitely think that people need to have confidence in the Secretary of State that the elections are overseen in a fair and impartial manner. I don't agree with the fact that Sam Reed, for example, is nonpartisan because he co-chairs Rob McKenna's committee this year. And that's something I would not do. I would not co-chair the political committees of people running for office as Secretary of State.
Staying out of it. Do you have anything you want to add to that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have always been very politically neutral publicly in terms of like social issues or signing a petition even because I think that it's important that people, it really doesn't matter. I'm not going to affect that policy as Secretary of State or as county auditor. So I make sure I stay neutral.
On the political issues, I would say that issues of civil rights are absolutely important to me. And that's why I'm wearing my approve referendum 74 pin today, because for 20 years, I've been an advocate for civil rights for the gay and lesbian community. When I served with Cal Anderson in the Senate, I supported the anti-discrimination bill. When it comes to anti-discrimination, I'm absolutely going to stand up and be counted, as well as women's rights, because in 1992, when I was elected to the state Senate, we passed legislation including making sure we had coverage, contraceptive coverage in this state, and I will always stand up for women's rights and for equal rights.
Do you think that some voters would see that as a conflict of interest if you're running the election overseeing process?
I don't think so. I think that voters expect to know where their leaders are coming from. We're not talking about liquor control issues. We're talking about people's rights.
And this is one area where Kathleen and I have a very different opinion. I think that it's imperative that people believe that it's being run in a neutral way. And you think back a couple years ago when the R71 petition was being checked, if it passed only with a few hundred signatures to spare, if they had known where Sam Reed stood on gay marriage, it affects the way they think that his office is checking that petition. And ultimately, you know, our job is to make people believe, the losers believe, that an election is fair. So
I disagree with that, because certainly everybody has a position on whether or not we should have marriage equality and on women's rights. So not saying your position is as much a smokescreen as anything else.
Oh, it's not a smokescreen. I categorically disagree. If you're running for Congress or governor, absolutely, it's fair game. If you're running for Secretary of State, you have to be neutral publicly.
I don't agree. You're not a judge, so.
Let's talk about when the Secretary of State office did come under scrutiny in 2004, when Washington State had that closest governor's race in U.S. history. And Sam Reed ended up getting very high marks for how he handled that situation, being very even-handed, and his ability to work across the party lines. Do you have examples of how you're able to do that, to work with each side of the issue when it's something so contentious like that?
Yes. And in fact, you know, having run about 80 elections, that's what I've been doing. And in Thurston County, for example, I'm the only countywide elected Republican. And I believe a lot of that is because our office operates in a very nonpartisan manner when we do elections. So we've had our share of close elections as well. And it's imperative that you are very open and transparent. I think the key to the Secretary of State's office is the same. You need to be transparent in how you're crafting legislation, how you're writing administrative rules. And you need to work with Democrats and Republicans to make sure everybody believes that it's in everyone's interest.
Kathleen Drew?
When I ran for the state Senate in the Issaquah 5th District, I was the only Democrat and the first Democrat elected east of Lake Washington. And to this day, there hasn't been another Democrat elected in that district. So I worked closely with the Republicans to make sure we built and grew our branch campus at the University of Washington Bothell. I sponsored and wrote the ethics legislation to make sure there was accountability in state government. So I have 20 years of experience of working across the aisle and getting things done.
I know that Sam Reed endorsed you, Kim Wyman. He was saying that present and former county auditors know the office best, was his opinion. 66 of them, including 24 Democrats, have endorsed you. So I wanted to ask you, Kathleen Drew, what makes you think you can do a better job than Kim?
Well, to begin with, let's talk about the fact that the Secretary of State's office is not managing elections, but supervising elections, and that I have support from county officials across the state. It's true. Kim has the support of county auditors. She's been one for 20 years. I have the support of the mayor of Everett, the mayor of Seattle, the mayor of Tacoma, the King County executive, city council members, legislators, the governor, the two U.S. senators. So there's a lot of support for how I can run this office as well.
And I know you think that because you've been doing it, you have more experience. So can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. And I think the endorsements are critical because I have bipartisan endorsements. They're not just Republicans. They're Republicans and Democrats. And it's people that have done elections from Secretary of State, state election directors and auditors. And I think it's more than just being able to do elections. It's about managing budgets. I've overseen multi-million dollar budgets. I've actually overseen hundreds of employees. I mean, the job isn't just running elections. It's actually managing a very large organization that's statewide, and that's really why I think I'm the best.
What I would say to that is certainly that my experience is that the Secretary of State's office is one of 80 departments at the state level. In order to get your agenda accomplished, you need to get your policy and budget passed through the legislature. You need to have their endorsement of what you want to do as Secretary of State. And that's what I've been doing. That's where I have experience. I've managed complex issues for many, many years, and I've shown results.
Let's talk about one of these issues that has to do with the budget. This year, most primary voters didn't receive a voter's pamphlet. They were cut to save about $1 million. Kim Wyman, do you think that was the right thing to do?
No, I wish that Sam had fought a little harder to get that money in his budget, or that the governor and the legislature would have worked to put that money there. It's important to have that printed voter's pamphlet because not everyone has online access. And the online access does help a lot, and there's other ways to mitigate it. But it's important that voters have that access to the printed pamphlet.
20 years ago, I sponsored legislation to require a printed primary voter's pamphlet. Unfortunately, that didn't happen, so I am absolutely committed to making it happen. Sam Reed did not even include it in his budget, so I think that was a significant mistake. And Kim did not include the statewide elected officials in the budget, in the pamphlet that she put out, and I think that was a huge mistake as well.
Kim, you're shaking your head. What do you want to say?
Well, to be fair, so counties do local voters' pamphlets. That's what the state allows. The state does the statewide voters' pamphlet. So we didn't include the statewide issues in our local voters' pamphlet that we printed because I'm on the ballot this year as a statewide candidate, and we've never done that before. And we thought that it would appear that we were using county funds for campaign purposes and that it wasn't in the interest of our citizens.
I would rather have the voters have information than make a political decision based on what voters think of me.
But it wasn't a political decision. This is the difference of being an elected executive and having to be held accountable by voters. It was a $20,000 expenditure. We actually put in our pamphlet that if people wanted to get a copy of the state voters pamphlet, that they could contact our office. We had 150 people who did that. So for 150 people, $20,000 was not a good expenditure of taxpayer dollars.
What do you think, to each of you, maybe we'll start with you, Kathleen, Drew, what do you think that the voter pamphlet needs to cover?
Well, I think it needs to cover all state races and that the Secretary of State needs to fund it. So I do think that was the first mistake. The second mistake was that not including the statewide races because there were so many on the ballot. King, Pierce, Snohomish, and Kitsap County figured out how to do that. And I don't accept the argument that not including it because your name was on the ballot is a legitimate excuse.
What do you think it should cover?
Well, like I said, the state law actually defines it. State law says a local voter's pamphlet is for local issues. And I was operating in the best interest of my citizens in my county. And the only person that has been taking me to task is a person who's running against me in this office. So, my voters, I think, were fine with that decision and believed it was the right one.
Well, we're not out of the woods as far as the budget is concerned in this state. Do you think, If both of you believe that the having the pamphlet out there is the most important thing, what would you cut otherwise if you had to streamline your office?
I would look at the money that is raised from documents and has been put aside for the Heritage Center, which is building a new building we can't afford right now. And I would look to those funds to fund the voter information, which is the highest priority to voters.
All right. What do you think, Kim Wyman?
Well, I think one of the nice things about a new person coming in is you get to restructure. And I think the first thing you've got to look at is just is where the money's being spent. I mean, Sam's office has about an $80 million budget, and it's about setting priorities. So you have to look at it comprehensively. I take a little bit of issue of money that is set aside in statute for a certain purpose being siphoned away for something that it wasn't intended for. So I think that it's mainly looking at, streamlining how you do business, and there are opportunities.
And there are opportunities to change the statute, too, which happens every year.
Mm-hmm. We're getting to know our candidates for Secretary of State today. Republican Kim Wyman is Thurston County Auditor. Before that, she served 9 years as election manager. And we're also joined with Democrat Kathleen Drew, who's the former Washington State Senator and policy advisor to Governor Gregoire. Let's look at the initiative process for a little bit. Since the Secretary of State's office handles the Citizens Initiative, some people believe that this process has gotten out of hand and we're ending up with things that we don't need because of it. Where do you stand on the initiative process? Kim, let's start with you.
I actually think the initiative process, even though we have paid signature gatherers and you have folks like Tim Iman who are very successful at getting a lot of things on the ballot, it's still working in the way that the framers intended. And so you have a many petitions that are filed, few that qualify for the ballot, and fewer that are passed into law. And I think that we just need to be careful. You start making changes, new requirements, or making it more difficult to do that, you're actually making it harder for that direct democracy that our state really values and prioritizes. So I think the system right now works pretty well.
Okay, what do you think?
Well, I think that there have been a lot of talk about changes. First of all, the money in the system is significant, but a lot of those are federal issues, such as looking at overturning Citizens United and how that might affect the disclosure of financial disclosure in our state. But if you get down to the issue of what's really going on with the signatures themselves, the issues that I would address is to require registration of the companies and the individuals who are collecting signatures so we know who they are and that we can go to them when they don't sign petitions, and we can look more closely when the signature gatherers return petitions without their signatures to make sure that there is not fraud. And those are the issues I'm most concerned about.
So would either one of you make any changes, like that we could pinpoint a change you would make if you were elected?
One of the things I would look at is the fact that I've heard that the signatures on petitions aren't as closely scrutinized as those on ballots. So administratively, I would look at that issue first. The other issues do take legislation, and I have talked to a number of people who have worked on ballot initiatives about the issue of making sure that we have companies and individuals who are collecting signatures to register with the Secretary of State's office.
All right, Kim Wyman.
You got to remember that you don't have a chilling effect on this direct democracy where people have an opportunity to make change. It's a relief valve for citizens to have that. So you have to be very careful. And in terms of the signature scrutiny, those signatures are scrutinized to the same standards that ballots are scrutinized to. Now, you do a random check. If you have a petition that requires 100,000 signatures and you turn in 1 million, you don't have to check every one of those million. But they are qualifying those signatures, and that process is sound.
All right, let's move on to another issue since we're running out of time. Do you think we need to improve voter turnout in Washington State? Kathleen Drew.
Absolutely. And if you look at the overall turnout, it of course fluctuates. But what we find, the Secretary of State doesn't keep any demographic information. So I've had to go to other sources to try and figure out who is it that is registered and voting. 80% of the eligible Caucasians register and vote. Or some portion of them vote. And then it drops to 50% for Asian Americans, Latinos, African Americans, and 19% for Native Americans who are eligible to vote, are registered to vote. So there are significant issues. And you also look at the young population. And that's why I'm so supportive of making sure we can pre-register 16 and 17-year-olds to vote before they are actually eligible to vote, because this way we can capture an audience that will then be registered to vote on their 18th birthday, will be paying more attention and be more active.
And how do you propose to pre-register them?
Well, primarily through driver's licenses. When you move to the state, you register to vote when you get your driver's license, primarily. But our kids can't do that because they're not old enough yet.
All right. What do you think of that idea?
This is way another contrast between Kathleen and I, because I have actually testified against that bill, mainly for reasons that I don't think it's going to make a difference in terms of participation rates for our young voters. The biggest one is that when you're capturing that data at 16, 2 years later is the point in their lives where most young people are the most mobile. They're moving off to college. They're getting their first job, moving out of the house. So that data is, it's potentially going to be very stale. And you're going to spend a lot of administrative time trying to capture that data, when a better use of that would be connecting with, high school students and doing civic outreach and helping them understand the importance of voting and their role in civic engagement. And really, if you look at the states that do pre-register 16 and 17-year-olds, what they found is it's actually, you have to do that civic engagement to actually increase turnout. Just simply registering them like the rest of the population, simple registration isn't going to be the key. We've been doing voter registration issues since the early 1990s with the National Voter Registration Act, Motor Voter, where you register when you get your driver's license. We haven't seen changes in participation levels. In fact, we've seen participation levels go down. So it's not the barriers to voting that's keeping people from participating. It is really what's on the ballot that drives those numbers.
I would also say that I would work to make sure we can register to vote all the way up to Election Day. As it is now, you can only register in person. First of all, you can register online 30 days ahead of time. You can register in person. Everyone out there who has not registered yet, you can go in person through Monday. But I'd like to see us move to make sure we can register and vote all the way up until Election Day. This has been done in Maine for 40 years. The state legislature took away that right. and the citizens put it back through an initiative. It is very important to people. People have busy lives. They don't remember all the deadlines and exactly when they need to get ready before Election Day to vote.
Well, what do you think of her idea of civic engagement as far as getting teenagers involved?
Well, I do think it's important to reach out to teenagers. But if you look at what's happening in North Carolina, who just put in the bill, in the legislation for registering 16 and 17-year-olds, they had many, many more 18-year-olds registered and ready to vote this year. So I'm very excited about actually getting young people pre-registered to vote.
So, Kim Wyman, what do you think actually would improve voter turnout among minority groups?
I think, again, it's civic outreach, and it's really going into those communities and engaging. I was just this last week at a luncheon in the Asian community for seniors, and it was really interesting because two-thirds of the room didn't speak English. And the woman who put this initiative together was telling us that her parents have been naturalized citizens for many years but never voted because they don't read English. And so it's getting out to those communities and educating them and helping them understand what they need to do to register to vote, where they get information. And I think we need to be doing that in every one of those communities that's under.
I actually agree with that. And that's what I've been doing through the campaign, which is why the Asian Pacific Islander community has endorsed me. The Filipino community has endorsed me. The Black Collective in Tacoma has endorsed me, and many of the Native American tribes as well.
Well, how do you have the personnel to get the boots on the ground to make that happen?
I really think you connect with the organizations that are already, the ones that Kathleen, for example, just listed. You connect with those organizations, and it's really, a lot of it is just volunteer efforts and really connecting staff with those people to reach those communities.
Getting citizens involved.
Yes,
is that
absolutely
what you do as well? Okay, well, we only have about 4 minutes left, and so I thought I would give you both an opportunity, maybe 2 minutes apiece, to tell people why you should be the one that they choose. Why don't we start with you, Democrat Kathleen Drew.
I have been engaged in getting people in the election process and involved in their community and democracy since I was very young. I remember going to the polls with my mom. I was a fourth out of six girls, and she'd take us all to the polls, even when there were levers and machines in the voting booths. But certainly since then, I was the student at the college gate who was registering students to vote with our bipartisan political interest club. Throughout my career, I've been engaged in making sure people participate in voting. I am passionate about voting and democracy. And I also bring a wealth of experience, a knowledge of how the state works, how to get things done at the state level with my background as a state senator and policy advisor to the governor. I have ideas to reform the corporations division to make sure that we have one-stop shopping for businesses, to make sure that businesses can interact with all state agencies. And I've done very similar work in streamlining government for the governor as well. So all of this wealth of experience I bring, plus the passion I have to ensure that every citizen is able to vote, that we remove barriers, that we make it easier for people to vote, and we stand up for rights.
That's Democrat Kathleen Drew. She's a former Washington State Senator and policy advisor to Governor Chris Gregoire. All right, Kim Wyman, what's your final statement?
Well, in 1990, I was overseas with my husband. He was in the Army, and we didn't get a ballot in time to vote in an election. And that was one of those defining moments where you realize how important that right is and that responsibility. 3 years later, I became the election supervisor and really made a commitment to learn the profession of elections, became a certified election administrator at the state and the national level, and have really spent the last 20 years making sure that every person in my charge has the opportunity to register and vote in every election they're eligible. With that said, I think that the third party endorsements are probably the thing that speaks volumes. So I have every daily newspaper in the state's endorsement. I have Democrats, Republicans, nonpartisan endorsements that go from state level officials to local level officials and citizens. And it really is, this race is about experience, and it's not just elections experience. It's about managing organizations and overseeing budgets and working with the legislature and making things happen and making sure our elections are protected. And that's what I'll bring to this office if elected.
That's Republican Kim Wyman, who's Thurston County Auditor. Before that, she served 9 years as election manager. Both candidates are running for Secretary of State, and they gave me the little tip that if you vote early, You will no longer get junk mail in the mail.
That's right.
An amazing breakthrough. I had no idea. I've always voted on the day. So thanks for that tip as well. And thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
Good morning, it's 9:29. I'm Andy Hurst. The Syrian government and rebel forces have agreed to a ceasefire for the next 4 days in commemoration of the Muslim holiday Eid al-Adha. Coming up next, we'll get the very latest from Scott Peterson. He's Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from area schools affiliated with the Pacific Northwest Association of Independent Schools. More information about open houses, financial aid, and the range of education choices such as Epiphany School are online at pnais.org.
Clouds and rain, 51 degrees in the University District. We're expecting clouds all day with occasional showers, the high in the low 50s. Clouds and rain tonight as well. The low near 47. We're expecting clouds and showers through the weekend. Tomorrow's high in the mid-50s. Sunday's high in the upper 50s.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. The Syrian government and rebel forces agreed to a ceasefire for 4 days to commemorate the Muslim holiday Eid al-Adha. The deal was brokered by the new UN envoy to Syria, led by Lakhdar Brahimi. This is the second proposed ceasefire. The last one in April was unsuccessful and caused then-UN ambassador to Syria Kofi Annan to resign. As the death toll rises above 35,000 and refugees flee the country, many wonder if peace is even possible in Syria. Scott Peterson, Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, just returned from Aleppo, Syria. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
I wanted to start out really basic for people who are just beginning to follow this ongoing story. Can you simply explain what's going on in Syria?
Well, at the moment, Syria has been undergoing an uprising against President Bashar al-Assad. It's lasted so far 20 months. The death toll has been extraordinarily high for what really amounts to one of the Arab uprisings. So far, we've got 30,000 dead or 35,000 dead, according to activists. The UN uses a figure of 20,000. Either way, the death toll has been very high, and for the last 2 or 3 months, the primary amount of fighting has been taking place in the city of Aleppo. This is a northern city, an economic hub, and one that has really seen some very serious amounts of government shelling of rebel-controlled areas. And there's a lot of hunger there. There's a lot of damage and devastation there. And really, what both the rebels and the government say is that the fate of Aleppo, whoever finally controls it when this fight is over, will be the winner finally of this battle.
Why Aleppo? Why is that the place that they need to take?
Aleppo is a place that is a crossroads. It also, because it's such a large and important commercial city, people feel that the government really can't stand any longer if it doesn't have the support of Aleppo. I mean, Aleppo is one of the places, a city that was quite late in joining the rebellion, as a matter of fact. I mean, there was a business community that was there that was seen to be fairly pro-regime, and it really took, you know, it was only a few months ago, in fact, when we began to see some student demonstrations there at the University of Aleppo, where things began to snowball for the people in Aleppo. At the same time, a few months ago, we also had an offensive by the Free Syrian Army rebels. This is the rebel group that's been slowly eating away at government control in northern Syria and also in other locations across the country. They actually began to take some territory in Aleppo itself. 3 months ago, I was there for the beginning of that assault as well. And so that really all of a sudden made Aleppo this crucible of the conflict. And like I say, both sides now, that both the government in Damascus as well as the rebels, feel that whoever's going to control this town is going to be the final victor in this fight for Syria.
Do you have a sense of how it's going to affect the region around it if the rebels do win?
Well, there are so many variables in this conflict, and the fact that it's gone on for 20 months means that it also, in many respects, has turned into a proxy war. This is no longer just a question of, shall we say, pro-democracy activists in Syria you know, kind of trying to claim democratic rights against an authoritarian regime. The same basic scenario that we saw last year in Egypt and Tunisia and eventually in Libya. What we've seen now is a fight that is really pitting not just the Syrians against the, you know, those who oppose them, the Syrian government against the, you know, the rebel groups. But what we're seeing is those rebel groups supported by Turkey, by Qatar, Gulf countries, other Sunni countries, and especially more broadly, by the United States, and they are against working against the Syrian government in Damascus, which has got very strong support from the Russians, especially, and also from Iran and from Hezbollah, which is the Shiite militia in Lebanon. So when you actually look at what could eventually happen here, we could see in this conflict reverberations across the region in ways that we simply haven't felt from some of the other Arab uprisings. And that simply is because there are so many other regional strategic calculations that all the players necessarily have to engage in.
Speaking with Scott Peterson, the Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, he was recently in Aleppo covering the Syrian conflict. Do you think that, in your opinion, the United States should be more involved than they are?
Well, one of the things that has really surprised me is the absolutely universal word that I've heard from Syrians, and this has been on this trip where I was in Aleppo for the last 4 days, and also when I was there a couple of months ago. But this time, it just seems that every single person is shouting for the same thing. They can't believe that the United States is not doing more to help them. They feel that theirs is a just and democratic cause against an authoritarian dictatorial leader. The United States has certainly said that, but we also know that there's been a very little help in terms of things on the ground. I mean, certainly the rebels don't feel that they are getting the kind of support that they need or desire. And what I heard from the lips of Syrians time and time again was there are two things that we need. They say that we need to have a no-fly zone, which would then stop Syrian aircraft and helicopters from dropping very large bombs on this city and others. That has really held back the opposition. And the other thing is they want to have more weapons. Now, of course, just to explain a little bit why the United States isn't helping more, and that is that there is concern from Washington that by supporting some of these groups, and some of these are jihadists and other groups who are busy fighting the government there, then you're basically supporting people who ideologically are somewhat allied to al-Qaeda or at least to kind of extremist Islamic ideologies. So they're kind of, in that sense, trying to find a fine balance. But what I can tell you is that the people in Aleppo and the Syrians I spoke to there certainly feel that the United States is not playing it right on this one.
Maybe you can help us picture this a little better, because when we hear about all this going on, it feels like we're so far away in the United States. And oftentimes it's abstractly, like it's getting lost in all this election coverage. So when we hear about rebel fighters or the Free Syrian Army, it kind of can conjure up some shady, ill-informed imagery. Can you give us a better mental picture of who these people actually are?
Well, I would say that the majority of the fighters are people who, at least as they describe themselves to me, describe themselves as moderate Muslims who are interested in basically toppling this government because they're sick of living under Assad family control, which they have lived under for the last 40 years in Syria. And so in that sense, they portray this as purely another pro-democracy Arab uprising. That said, there are also, as time goes on and as this conflict goes on, there is an increasing number of Islamist and jihadist groups that are working inside, some of them, you know, close to al-Qaeda, not a large number, but, you know, but they're also just a large number of people who are actual jihadists. And when you ask Syrians about them, they basically say, well, at the moment, this is kind of a necessary evil. This is one of the, as they say, this is one of the fallout. This is some of the fallout from not getting more support from the West. We basically have to accept support from anybody who is willing to fight with us. And if these jihadist groups are willing to do it, then, you know, who are we to send them away? You know, we should basically accept their help, and we'll just have to deal with, you know, kind of the ideological results later. So the Syrians who I spoke to, and I did delve deeply into this issue when I was there speaking, especially to rebel commanders and others, they really downplay the dangers of the kind of the Islamist element. They think it's something that was going to be able to be managed, and they feel it's being over-exaggerated as a threat or a risk by Washington.
And what about life for civilian people with all this fighting going on in the streets around them? What are they doing? How are they getting through the day?
Well, Aleppo is a city of, it used to be a city of 3 million people. Now it's estimated to have 2.5 million. They live extremely tense, difficult lives these days. I mean, the problem is that for all those, for the large swaths of the city which are controlled by the rebels, which is more than 50 or 60% of the city, in fact, at least, you know, based on what people told me and also the number of places I was able to get to in the city, all those areas have become a free fire zone for the government. So they have been bombarded with artillery, with heavy guns, and also with mortars, and also craft helicopters, which have also dropped what they call barrel bombs, which are barrels full of TNT. And these have been very destructive. I mean, there's some districts now which have basically been emptied of people that look like, you know, like the Chechen capital of Grozny when the Russians destroyed it in the mid 1990s. I mean, you know, incredible scenes of destruction that we just don't see very often. And of course, people get caught in this. So, you know, when I visited the hospital there, there are casualties coming in constantly with very serious traumatic wounds from shrapnel and other things. Those are, of course, the people who are living. I mean, the number of dead just keeps on rising. But, I mean, the human carnage and the cost of this is something extraordinary and something that, you know, that people there are inevitably having to live with. I mean, not everybody can leave a city of that size. And, of course, a city of that size also means that you know, people, by and large, wake up every day, you know, roll the dice and take their chances, and most of them survive till the next day. But it's extremely difficult conditions for people there now.
We're speaking with Scott Peterson, Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He was just in Aleppo covering the Syrian conflict. While there was supposed to be a break, Scott, the Syrian government and the rebel forces agreed to a ceasefire for 4 days to commemorate the Muslim holiday Eid al-Adha. But we're now hearing reports that there are gunfire anyway. How is the ceasefire brokered, and is there any chance that they're going to get a day off?
Well, a little bit of gunfire isn't that big a concern, frankly. I mean, you'd be surprised if there was no gunfire at all. I mean, just in the last hour or two, I've actually been in contact with people inside Syria, inside Aleppo, and they said that up until then, it had been a quiet day, meaning no heavy artillery, no shelling, and that therefore the ceasefire, at least up until then, had been holding. I mean, gunfire comes and goes, and that really doesn't, I don't think, constitute or would, you know, be seen by the main players as to constitute anything more than, you know, snipers firing the odd round or something. But that's not the same as, you know, as actually the government unleashing big guns on neighborhoods. So that, at least up until an hour or two ago, seems not to have been happening. But, you know, my contacts in Aleppo are also saying that at the moment the situation is very, very unstable, and therefore that this situation isn't likely to continue, that the ceasefire probably isn't going to continue, that it is going to be dangerous, and there's, you know, and it probably is going to be broken at some point. How that will happen, nobody knows. What is actually happening behind the scenes right now in terms of people, both sides kind of reinforcing their lines and that sort of thing, I don't know, but this certainly seems to have been the quietest day in a very, very long time in Aleppo today.
Well, a lot of foreign journalists have had trouble getting into Syria to cover this conflict at all, so how have you been managing to get in?
Well, it's extremely difficult. I mean, I've been doing this kind of thing for, you know, for more than 20 years, and it's, you know, every conflict presents a different set of issues and a different set of problems and challenges. This one, the challenge, of course, one of the challenges is that once, you know, if you actually can finally get in there, find the people who you can trust to get you in there, you still need to be able to move around. You still need to be able to, you know, to do it with a degree of relative safety, and you know, when you've got this kind of indiscriminate bombardment going on, then that's extremely difficult. You know, I mean, the place where I stayed was a place where basically none of the neighbors or anyone else knew where I was staying, knew that a foreigner was there. And when I went out onto the streets, not that I can hide necessarily among Syrians, but you can wear certain things. I mean, I, you know, would do things like wear my bulletproof vest or my, you know, my shrapnel vest and things underneath a larger shirt or a larger jacket, something like that. So at least at first glance, you know, you're not going to kind of, you know, it's not going to be a really high profile. I mean, people don't mind necessarily having journalists there. It's just that, you know, you don't really want a lot of people to know you're there. There are an awful lot of spies on both sides of this front line. And you know, so I must say it's one of the reasons why we limit our time in there. And this particular visit, I arrived on Monday, I left on Thursday, and, you know, you probably wouldn't want to spend much more time than that in a single place. I was in Aleppo all that time. And, you know, you wouldn't really want to spend an awful lot of time there because it just increases the chances of something going wrong. But, you know, if you do have people who you can work with and who you trust, you know, you need to keep in mind that every day, the very vast majority of those 2.5 million people in Aleppo, you know, are going to survive the day. So while we definitely have seen a lot of casualties and a lot of people have suffered there, you know, that said, their stories are worth telling, and there are ways, you know, of being among those who are going to wake up and go to bed every day.
Why take the risk yourself? I know that a lot of people in Syria are trying to get the story out from within, but why take the risk yourself to go in?
Well, I think that you can, you know, there are ways that you can make it a manageable and acceptable risk. I mean, you know, there's no such thing as no risk for anything. I mean, you know, I was just in Seattle a couple of weeks ago and, you know, could have been run over by a car, and the same thing could happen in Istanbul where I am at the moment. So, you know, those are risks, but they're acceptable ones. And, you know, for the people who do the work that I do, you know, in Syria, it has been extremely excruciating. This year has been very difficult. We've lost a number of our colleagues going in, Marie Colvin, Anthony Shadid, just to name a couple, but there have been several others. It's been a very tough year. We haven't had a year like this, I don't think, for journalists, you know, going back for a little while. And it just points out how excruciatingly difficult it is and how frustrating it is for those of us. I mean, I live in Turkey, which is the, you know, the next country over, and we've had, you know, between 20,000 and 35,000 people die on this story in the last 20 months. But the number of times I've been able to get in a safe enough manner is, you know, less than the number of fingers on one hand. I mean, it's been that difficult. And so, you know, people take great care. We take great care. And there's a lot of preparation going into a visit like the one that I just took. This does not happen overnight. We don't just willy-nilly go in and take our chances. And for those of us who've been doing it for a while, you know, who worked under, you know, kind of equally excruciating circumstances in Baghdad, which I did for years and years, you know, you learn techniques for you know, maximizing your chances of success and making the risks, you know, manageable.
Scott Peterson is Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He was recently in Aleppo this week covering the Syrian conflict. Well, next time you're in Seattle, Scott, stop by. We'll have you on the show.
Thank you.
This is Weekday.
Good morning, it's 9:46. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. I'm Andy Hurst. Scott McClellan served as press secretary for George W. Bush from 2003 to 2006. Yet 4 years ago, he voted for President Barack Obama. And last month, he became VP of Communications for Seattle University. Scott McClellan will be here later today. He talks with KUOW's Ross Reynolds this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley and its evening and weekend MBA program, offering a Saturday option for working professionals from outside the Bay Area who can earn a Berkeley MBA while working full-time. Information session on November 7th at the Renaissance Seattle Hotel.
New flight attendants are sick a lot because it's kind of like a kindergarten teacher. You're exposed to a lot of germs, mainly because I'm taking garbage from everyone, you know, and saying thank you for it. Thank you. Thank you for your garbage.
Join us for the Moth Radio Hour, True Stories Told Live, from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
That comes your way Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock. We have clouds and showers, 50 degrees in the University District, working towards a high today of 51. Forecast calls for clouds and occasional rain the rest of today. We're expecting clouds and showers tonight and through the weekend. Tonight's low 47, tomorrow's high in the mid-50s.
Support for KUOW comes from Athena Health, helping physicians secure meaningful use while focusing on patient care. More about cloud-based EHR and practice management services is at athenahealth.com.
This is Weekday. I'm Katie Sewell. American Indian activist, artist, and actor Russell Means died earlier this week at the age of 72. He joined the American Indian movement in 1968. 30 years ago, he was part of an armed takeover of Wounded Knee in South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation. You might also remember him from film. He played Chingachgook in Last of the Mohicans, and he was also a voice in Disney's Pocahontas. He was in Natural Born Killers. He frequently appeared on Curb Your Enthusiasm. And he visited the KUOW studios in 2009 to talk to Steve Scher. We wanted to play a little bit of that interview back to remember him.
AIM was a vanguard, as I mentioned earlier, a vanguard for self-determination among Indian people. Well, guess what? It succeeded.
It's another amazing.
Fantastically, in fact, around the world. We spearheaded the International Indian Treaty Council, which is with part of the UN now, and we spearheaded the rights of indigenous people. We spearheaded that conference in the 1980s in Geneva, Switzerland. So not only did we spearhead the right of self-determination in among American Indian people throughout the Americas, but also indigenous people worldwide, culminating in 07 when the UN adopted the rights of indigenous people. And there's only four countries voted against it. And it's a non-binding resolution, by the way. A non-binding resolution. The United Nations passed the rights of indigenous people. Only four countries voted against it. The United States of America, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. Hello? That insult is worse than wiping us out militarily. That is the biggest insult, that we do not matter. A non-binding resolution, not going to hurt the United States or any of these white people of English descent. It's not going to hurt them. It's a non-binding. I mean, Russia, China, Venezuela, Brazil voted for it. People with all of Africa, with people with indigenous people within their borders, except these four white countries.
Well, what were they afraid of?
I have no idea that they are so racist that to tell the United Nations and the rest of the world, which is the whole world, that we don't exist. We're not important. We're going to vote against this. They have no rights because they don't exist. It was literally, and I mean that, it was a literal massacre of indigenous people around the world.
But what's grown out of that? How have you responded? I mean, that's pretty strong to say worse than being wiped out. So what's grown out of that? Don't you think?
No, you know what's going on about it? The Republic of Lakota. Hello? But, you know, these tribal governments, they don't even realize it happened. If you ask them about the rights of indigenous people, they grunt around and they don't know a damn thing about this insult. Instead, they become Obamatized.
Obamatized.
They're waiting around for their, what does he call that money he's throwing around?
Stimulus package.
Stimulus. They're waiting for their stimulus. Idiotic.
Can I ask you a couple of personal questions? Because in your book, you write about your change as you grew to adulthood and older age. Do you see a different person today than were you a more angry, violent, colonized person when you were a child and a teenager in your 20s than you are today?
I don't think I was colonized completely, because my grandmas and my grandpas and my mother made sure that I was to be proud of the blood that courses through my veins and my ancestors. So they independently taught me some of my own history as a Lakota. Now, I did try to become a facsimile white person.
How?
I became an accountant and a drunk and a thief and a doper and a dope dealer. I mean, all the greats of white society. And I, through the American Indian Movement, I cleansed myself. And then eventually, I went to treatment, to a white man's institution, to decolonize myself completely emotionally so that I could get on a decent path. And it resulted in my marrying Pearl Dinetka Daniel. And I've got the perfect matriarchal marriage and the most wonderful woman on earth.
That's American Indian activist, artist, and actor Russell Means speaking with Steve Scher. Russell Means died earlier this week at the age of 72.
And now.
This is the
sound of the week.
Sound of the week.
That sound comes to us from our bicycle correspondent, Willie Weir, who's currently over in Bangkok. He writes, it's 11 a.m. and it's hot and humid, around 90 degrees. And we're in Big Central Park in central Bangkok. And we happen upon a teacher who is putting the percussion section of a student band through the drills. He continues on, to make this sound clip even more complete, you should also know that every single time a kid makes a mistake, they have to do 2 to 5 push-ups. They ran the section you're hearing right now over 20 times, and the kid who was playing the gong just couldn't seem to get it right. On the positive side, he was getting a very good upper body workout. So what sounds are you hearing, encountering, listening for? We want to hear the interesting sounds in your life. Record 30 seconds, send it to us along with the story behind it. Email it to weekday@kow.org with sound of the day in the subject line. Let us in on your day through the sounds that you're hearing. We want to hear from you. weekday@kow.org. And now joining us with a look at the weekend weather forecast is Nick Bond, Washington State climatologist, works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. He joins us every Friday with a look for the rest of the weekend. Hi, Nick.
Hey there.
So how's the weekend looking?
Well, it looks pretty soggy. Definitely a rainy day today. It may probably going to be tapering off into showers somewhere late this afternoon or early evening, but then rain at times on Saturday. No gully washer, but basically a wet day, especially in the South Sound. A little bit warmer. Today it's only probably going to get around 50 or so and maybe get into the low to mid-50s tomorrow and a little warmer on Sunday. And Sunday morning might be okay if you're looking for a time to clean out the drains and gutters or whatever. But then again, rain probably picking up in the early afternoon.
But the real story, of course, isn't happening here. I'm surprised that we have this big storm that's approaching the East Coast, and really we haven't been talking about it all that much.
Yeah, well, we should be because it is a big deal. And it's Hurricane Sandy is moving north from the Bahamas over the next couple of days, and it's going to be interacting with this mid-latitude storm. And so it's actually going to strengthen off of Cape Hatteras, make a bit of a left turn, and then landfall anywhere from Virginia to Cape Cod with a wide swath of all sorts of hazards, wind, rain, storm surge, snow further inland. It's going to be a big deal. By some measures, it could be a record-setting storm in terms of how low the pressure gets in some places along the East Coast.
And what does that mean when low pressure comes in?
Well, generally, low pressure is bad, and so it's one measure of the strength of the storm, and this one is of historical strength. And you have to go back. One storm that it's been likened to is the perfect storm of October 1991. Hurricane Hazel in 1954 had something kind of like it, but you know, these don't happen all the time.
So we're looking at a situation where we might need to send help in to help people after this storm hits?
Well, yeah. And, you know, just exactly where it goes and how it's going to play out is unknown. Still, there's a range in exactly where it's going to get make landfall. But it's a big storm, and it's sure to have some big impacts. As far as I'm concerned, it's kind of a welcome break from all the politics on the news. It's almost like there's an election coming up or something. But I don't mean to, you know, make light of it. It's going to be a serious event.
Well, and real briefly, like, how do we model storms like this?
Well, we have computer models that run from various centers all over the world. And what's kind of interesting for this storm, we were seeing indications of it in some of the models as early as Monday, especially one run by a European Center for Medium-Range Weather Forecasting. And that consistently is the best model. The American model in the last couple of days is kind of coming on board, but it is kind of interesting. It's good that we have multiple models because you shouldn't put all your eggs in one model basket.
Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. So we'll put on our rain slickers this weekend, Nick, and talk to you next week.
Yep.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Coming up next hour, we're going to be joined by our panel of journalists for the Week in Review Roundtable. Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, Knut Berger, and C.R. Douglas are joining us. Stay with us. I'm Katie Sewell, sitting in for Steve Scherr.
It's coming up on 10 o'clock. Headlines from NPR News are next.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW Medicine Multiple Sclerosis.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.